Hi, Jeffrey. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Perfect. Just want to do a quick sound check. Thank you very much. All right. I call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Let the record reflect that it is 10:17 a.m. on Thursday, April 15th, 2021. Present today, we have Representative Klayman, Vice Chair Zolkowski, Representative Rauscher, Representative Kaufman, and myself, Chair Schrage. In the audience, we also have Representative McKay, and online, we have Representative Johnson. Welcome to our committee. As we start, I'd like to remind committee members to please silence their cell phones. And I want to thank our House Records Secretary, Chris Dillon, and our LIO moderator, Marissa Truitt, for helping us with behind-the-scenes work for our committee today. Today, we'll be bringing House Bill 170 back before this committee to take invited testimony and allow committee members to ask questions of the administration. First off, we're going to have Chris Rose, the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, also known as REAP, before the committee. Thank you for being here today, Mr. Rose. If you could please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to House Bill 170 today. My name is Chris Rose, and I'm the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP, and I am here today to support the passage of House Bill 170. REAP applauds Governor Dunleavy's introduction of this legislation to create an Alaska Energy Independence Fund. And we greatly appreciate all the work that the governor's office and ADA staff have put into developing the legislation. Before I begin, I also want to thank the two experts who you'll hear speak after me. Bert Hunter has spent countless hours explaining the Green Bank concept to me and bankers, business leaders, and policymakers in Alaska over the last 4.5 years, including 3 trips to Alaska. And Jeff Shub has also been an incredibly generous resource with his time and knowledge, has traveled to Alaska, and is a tireless advocate for clean energy financing across the country. I thank them both for all the time and effort they have put into understanding Alaska's unique energy landscape. So if we could go to the second slide, please. Just a little bit of background on REAP. We are a statewide nonprofit education and advocacy group. We've been around since 2004. We are a coalition of over 60 dues-paying members that include utilities, businesses, renewable energy developers, local governments, native corporations, educational institutions, other NGOs, And our mission is simply to increase the development of renewable energy and promote energy efficiency across Alaska. Next, please. Some of our programs here, we really focus a lot on people, building human capacity through K-12 energy literacy education. We have 3 K-12 STEM educators supported by the Office of Naval Research who promote and disseminate STEM curricula across the state of Alaska to promote energy literacy. We also launched in 2017, also with LNR support, the Alaska Network for Energy Education and Employment, which is a program to pull together the K-12 university and workforce sectors in the state to prepare people for a workforce in clean energy. The way that we see this whole ecosystem is it's really 4 buckets. It's technology, and that's not really what we are doing. We're not engineers. But the other 3 buckets is where we work. And people, finance, and policy are those 3 other buckets. And really, when we're talking about clean energy finance today, we're really focused on both policy and finance. But a big part of REAP's effort is to promote the human capacity development in the state so these projects can be operated and maintained successfully, and we create more jobs here in the state. Next, please. This is just a rundown of some of the advocacy that we have done over the years, starting in 2008 when we were instrumental in pushing for the Alaska Renewable Energy Fund, which was passed in that year. That has provided over $270 million in state appropriations for renewable energy projects, mostly in rural Alaska. But it's also leveraged about $200 million in federal and state, federal and private money to build more than 80 projects that Alaska Energy Authority is estimating save about 30 million gallons of diesel every year across the state of Alaska. We've most recently been involved in rail belt grid reform legislation that passed last year. That is now creating an electric reliability organization for the entire rail belt, which will both promote more renewable energy development, but also save consumers money over the long run through integrated resource planning and regional standards. Next, please. I guess I'd start with the why we need clean energy financing here. And one of the reasons is that we have a lot of inefficient energy use here in the state. This is a slide one of our interns put together years ago. We just named it Alaska's billion-dollar bonfire. And this is based on the fact that both REAP, ADA, other entities are estimating that Alaskans are spending collectively almost $6 billion a year on electricity, heating, and transportation fuel. And we are estimating that probably conservatively we're wasting at least $1 billion worth of that energy every year. So 15 to 20% of that energy, I think, is a pretty good estimate. That is money that is leaving our economy unnecessarily, and it's not getting us any new benefit because the energy that's being used is being used inefficiently. So this is our low-hanging fruit. Next, please. Just to emphasize energy efficiency being our first fuel, none of us want to waste anything. We want to be as efficient as possible. And we believe that if we focus in on energy efficiency to make all of these sectors more efficient, whether it's making your home more airtight and putting a new heating system in, or using local renewable energy, or promoting electric transportation in the future, in the near future, that's going to save money. It's going to keep dollars circulating in our economy. Next, please. Part of why we are so interested in promoting energy efficiency is because we know it's worked. There's been a demonstration of that. Over the course of about 6 or 7 years, the legislature appropriated $640 million to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation for home weatherization and rebate programs. And those programs serve more than 50,000 households in the state. Those 50,000 households are on average, according to HFC, saving about 30% on their energy bills, mostly heating. That's a fantastic amount of savings. And collectively, HFC is estimating that that's the equivalent of 25 million gallons of heating oil every year. So that's a lot of energy savings that has been done. And all that was done through grants. That was money that the legislature gave to HFC, which then gave to citizens of the state. We just don't have that grant money anymore. So we we're working on ways to figure out how to keep that kind of energy efficiency and home weatherization going. Next, please. The Renewable Energy Fund, which I mentioned before, again, saving 30 million gallons of diesel every year. We want to make sure that we can continue to promote renewable energy here in the state without necessarily relying on grants. Next, please. This next slide just simply shows a comparison of the cost of electric generation. This is worldwide. This is done every year by Lazard, which is an international consulting firm. And this is an unsubsidized apples-to-apples analysis of all the generation resources on the planet. And you can see that in the bottom, we've got conventional. On the top, we've got alternative. But right now, you can see that now large-scale solar and wind is the cheapest electricity on the planet. And this is important because this is no longer something that we're hoping for to be cheaper in the future. It's already at grid parity or cheaper in most places around the world, and a growing number of places around the world. Solar has come down 90% in the last 10 years. Wind has come down 70% in the last 10 years. And so this is the most economic electricity that we can get. And as we move toward electrifying transportation and even heat, the source of our electricity is going to be more and more important. Next, please. This is just a slide to begin to understand why we need this, why private financing is not necessarily available right now. I'll give you one personal example. I wanted to put solar on my house, and I looked around for a loan from my credit unions that I belong to. The best I could do was 8%, and I've got good credit. Meanwhile, those same credit unions would give me a 3% car loan. Now, the car depreciates the moment I drive it off the lot. The energy efficiency in solar that I might want to borrow money for improves the value of my property. So what we're trying to do is help the private sector understand what this new animal of clean energy financing is. There's just a short track record for that, and that's part of the reason you can't just go down to the credit union and get an inexpensive loan for this. Also, the banks rightly perceive these projects as relatively small for them, and they're distributed. There's no aggregation of these projects. There's no secondary market to sell these loans on, in Alaska at least. One of the people that you'll hear from in a minute, Bert Hunter from the Connecticut Green Bank, has seen how that's been now successfully done in Connecticut. But what we want to do is create a secondary market for these kinds of clean energy loans. So just like when you get a letter after you finance a car saying your loan's been sold, you wouldn't be surprised to get a similar letter later on if you get a clean energy finance loan that loan has also been sold. And it's also just human organizational behavior. Things change slowly sometimes. Next, please. Elements of green.
Excuse me, Mr. Rose, if I could interrupt you for a moment. Representative Fields, who joined us at 10:23 a.m., has a question. Please proceed.
Through the chair. Hi, Mr. Rose. Congratulations on having a vehicle to do the Green Bank. It's very exciting. I think my question is, you know, looking at the scale of projects for a small rural Alaska community versus some of the larger projects we might see in the lower 48, is there the risk that capital will migrate to these larger projects, and is that an argument that we should be entertaining the possibility for potentially grants to some of our smaller, maybe more rural projects to complement loans within a Green Bank structure? Is that something that you've thought about?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, thank you. We don't want to get rid of the Renewable Energy Fund. We'd love to see more funding for the Renewable Energy Fund. There are also federal grants available. The one thing that an entity like the Alaska Energy Independence Fund can do is build a financing stack for projects. So if there are grants available, that may be the bottom of that financing stack, and moving up, trying to find different ways to finance the complete project. The other part of the answer to the question, I think, is what programs that ADA may develop under the EIF first. And we certainly are hoping that energy efficiency projects are you know, at the top of that list, because those are the least risky kinds of projects. And we want to get our feet on the ground and do as much energy efficiency as we can, and then move toward the generation projects that I think you're alluding to, which might be larger projects. The very large projects don't need financing. They can get that on the open market. But I think you're talking about more of the village scale type of generation project, and that might be something that this fund could handle at some point, but that would be, I think, a tailored program.
Okay, thank you. And I see no other questions at this time, so please proceed, Mr. Rose. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I'm on elements of green banks. Just a few elements, and again, the folks after me will touch on this a lot more than I. But one of the things to note is this is a fund that would focus on commercial technologies. We're not talking about funding experimental or emerging technologies. Typically, there's a dedicated source of capital. In this case, the governor has asked for a $10 million appropriation to get this kicked off. It would be nice to have an ongoing source of capital because that gives certainty to the businesses that will be developing businesses and creating jobs that there's going to be an ongoing source of financing and that they can safely hire more people to do the work as time goes on. That's helpful. We do have an ongoing source of capital. A big focus of these funds, like the AKEIF, is to leverage private financing. And you'll hear more about that. But a $10 million appropriation, for instance, we would hope would leverage at least 3-4 and maybe up to 5-7 times that amount in private capital as we move on. That's typical of these types of institutions and finance entities around the country, is you're taking a relatively modest amount of private money and then leveraging it. And typically there is a relationship with government, and here we feel like ADA is a great place for this fund to be housed. Next, please. So on the functions of the Green Bank, one of the things that I would emphasize is the Green Bank does some of the heavy lifting. In this case, the Alaska Energy Independence Fund would do the heavy lifting of designing these loan programs so that they can then go out to the private banking sector and educate them on an opportunity to get involved and participate in those programs. The other thing that AKEIF would do is actually market these programs, because if you have a good product and you don't market it, we all know that nobody takes advantage of it. We want the average person around the state of modest means to be able to take advantage of these programs. And they have to know about that, which means we're going to have to market them. And again, focus on the leverage of the private capital. Next, please. And this is my last slide. This is just a summary, I think, of what we believe this Alaska Energy Independence Fund can and will do for the state. First, it's going to lower the energy burden of Alaskans. We heard the other day from Mr. Weitzner from ADA just how high the energy burden is in the state of Alaska. In rural Alaska, people are often paying up to 50% of their take-home pay for energy. That's a huge burden. This will lower that. It will also create new investment opportunities for Alaska lending institutions that are not currently involved in a heavy way in this sector. It'll create jobs and also develop businesses, because we're going to need more people to do all this work. The 50,000 homes that have already been retrofitted, for instance, is just a fraction of the homes in the state that could use weatherization. Importantly, it'll keep dollars that are now unnecessarily being spent on energy flowing in the economy for other purposes. People will be able to use those dollars to do other things. And we're also going to position ourselves to receive federal money. You'll hear from Mr. Shub later talking about the federal legislation that is pending in Congress. It's already passed the House twice. It's being supported by Congressman Young as a co-sponsor. But the state of Alaska would receive a significant amount of money if a federal green bank is created and we have our own vehicle here. So with that, I would thank you for the opportunity to talk and answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Mr. Rose. I'd like to recognize that Representative Tuck joined us at 10:33 this morning, and Representative Rauscher, I believe, has a question.
Thank you, Chair. Chairman Shravi. Chris, how you doing?
Good, thank you. How are you today?
Good. So basically, before, I had heard you say you tried to get a loan, and it was at 8%. 8% was the best you can come up with, right? And for some weatherization for your home. And I also think I heard you say that there's just nobody to purchase the loans when you're talking about the financial world, which makes them very hard to get, which tells me that there's a high risk with the loans. Is that correct, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask?
I think there's a perceived risk. I think there's really less risk than the 3% loan I could get for a car. because the money that I may borrow to improve my property actually increases the value of my property. But more importantly, these loans are typically designed so that a person's loan payment equals their energy savings. And so you are decreasing the risk of their ability to pay it back by decreasing their energy bills. So that's all in the loan design, so that you are, for instance, saving $300 a month on your energy bills and paying $300 a month back on the loan.
Follow up?
Please, Mr. Rauscher.
Okay, and I get the understanding because I agree with you, but I'm trying to figure out what the risk actually is. I mean, that's your understanding why there shouldn't be a risk, but it appears that it says to me that there is a risk, and do you know what that risk is? Otherwise, banks would be more apt to try and lend the money. So there must be a risk, and I was wondering if you know what that risk is.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, one analogy is that you couldn't get a car loan the day cars were invented. The banks had to understand what cars were before they would, and what the risk profile was before they would develop a loan program for those. It's very similar in this sense. We've got new financing for things that the banks have not financed before. But to answer your question, there's not very much risk, particularly in energy efficiency. With almost scientific precision, you can determine what kind of savings you're going to get with a new boiler or more insulation or a certain kind of window. And those savings then can be calculated into the design of a loan program, and there's very little risk. But there is a perceived risk. I would say that the risk goes up if you're talking about a large generation project that also requires 25 years of operations and maintenance, which is harder to predict into the future. But with energy efficiency, there's no O&M. You put the energy efficiency benefit in or improvement in, and then it just does its thing without tinkering with it. So there's very little risk with energy efficiency loans.
And Representative Rauscher, I might just note that we will have Bert Hunter, Chief Investment Officer of the Connecticut Green Bank, testifying in just a moment, and he might be able to provide some insight into their experience as well.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Chris, and thank you also, Chairman.
And Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair. To Representative Rauscher, I think one of the differences I can immediately think of is you can repossess a car, but it's hard to recover rooftop solar insulation. So that just may be, you know, one of the things that comes up. But the other question to Mr. Rose, do we have, I'm sure we do somewhere, but I would like to see analysis of, like, rooftop solar when loaded with snow and all that, of what the seasonal curves are typically for installation, let's say, like in Anchorage. I'm curious what that would look like. I know a lot of folks are interested in rooftop solar, and I would like to know more about the energy viability of it, for, you know, the return on investment. So if you put rooftop solar on, what the net return looks like, you know, considering the declination of the sun, snow loading, and all of those things. Thank you.
Representative, through the chair, on the solar question, the Alaska Center of Energy and Power and others are tracking that. There's been a huge hockey stick uptick in solar installations in the rail belt over the last several years. And part of the reason is the price has just come down so much. You know, we may only be able to generate power 9 months a year with solar in Alaska, but the cost of the appliances come down so much that people buy it anyway. I mean, we park our cars 95% of the time, but we still have a car. And so I think people are starting to look at solar as a similar type of appliance that they may not get 100% benefit from. Depending on the slope of your roof, the snow may slough off, but just in the last couple months, we're now ending the snow season, we have the best solar production of the year in the springtime because of the reflection off of the snow typically. So if your panels are actually free of snow, they're going to produce a ton of power in, you know, late February through early April.
Would you like a follow-up, Representative Kaufman?
Thank you. Yes, through the chair. Thanks. I appreciate that. And yeah, I know that effect from sunburns that I've gotten, so it is real. I'm not saying it wouldn't be worth installing. I would just be interested in seeing if we have those numbers anywhere, as there's more installations, if that data is available. Thank you.
Through the chair, I can try to get those numbers for you, Representative.
Wonderful. And if you would send those numbers to the chair, we would be sure to get that out to all the members of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Rose. With that, Representative Zlotkovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if Mr. Weitzner from ADA is available for a question.
Through the chair, this is Alan Weitzner, Executive Director for Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. I am available to address questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weitzner, we heard this morning just in Mr. Rose's testimony that energy efficiency is, of course, the low-hanging fruit that will likely have more immediate return on investment of projects. And I know that you alluded to this in your testimony on Tuesday. Is ADA committed to initially pursuing energy efficiency project development first, whether residential or commercial?
Through the chair, Representative, there is no first phase in the proposal with the legislation. What we're addressing here is a broad access under the programs for what's defined as sustainable energy development. And that includes all aspects for programs. And what we've highlighted in the process of this with the legislation is establishing that advisory board, which would give us that input on what those programs should be as they get implemented, and having the advice coming in on the technical capacity from our sister agency, the Alaska Energy Authority. And I see that as ultimately the development of these programs, as well as ADA working directly with our financial sector within Alaska and their input ultimately on the programs are being able to be established.
Follow-up?
Thank you.
Representative Zlotkovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you for that answer, Mr. Weitzner. I guess what I'm looking to understand is it the commitment through passage of this legislation to establish loan funds for energy efficiency, since we know that that is the low-hanging fruit with respect to being able to help communities that need it. Is there intention to develop loan products through this legislation that would address energy efficiency?
Through the chair, Representative Zlotkovsky, most definitely that there are going to be programs to address energy efficiency. It is within the definitions that we have for sustainable energy development. I'm just trying to highlight that the creation of programs and the availability of funding for those programs would be to address the full aspect of defined sustainable energy development.
Follow-up?
One more, and then I'd like to go to the next presenter, please. Representative Zlotkovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then in a final question, Mr. Weitzner, as we also heard from Mr. Rose, with respect to energy efficiency projects, individuals that are doing those assessments are able to identify with scientific precision the return on investment that would likely be experienced by either the residential user or the commercial user. Is ADA also committed through the development of this, or through potential passage of this legislation, to develop loan loss revenues that can ensure, as Representative Fields indicated, that there's parity in the location of individuals who are looking to utilize this funding?
Through the chair, Representative Zlotkovsky, I would say that is how those programs would be established, based upon information coming in on the applicability of the different programs, where the best advantages are in place. Ultimately, in this case, when we talk about energy efficiency, the most optimal efficiencies are being achieved across the board with the energy needs within the state of Alaska. So we would be looking at that with all the different communities and what particular programs work to obtain those efficiencies. And I believe that is part of the input that we would get from our advisory board and the way it would be structured, and ultimately the input that we're getting on the technical capacity and experience base that we have with the Alaska Energy Authority.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weissner and Mr. Rose. Really appreciate that. If you could both remain online, I'm sure that we'll have some additional questions for you both. With that, up next, we have Bert Hunter, Chief Investment Officer of the Connecticut Green Bank. Welcome, Mr. Hunter. Thank you for joining us. If you could please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair Schrage. I am Bert Hunter, and I am the Chief Investment Officer of the Connecticut Green Bank. It is my pleasure to be with the committee today. I just want to make sure, can you hear me?
Loud and clear, thank you.
Great, thank you. It's my pleasure to be with the committee today to present about the activities of our state-sponsored Green Bank, and that hopefully will offer you a clearer understanding of what a Green Bank does, how we interact with the market, and the impact we have had, which could serve as a frame of reference for the types of activities, broadly speaking, that the Alaska Energy Independence Fund might undertake for the benefit of Alaska's residents, businesses, and state and local governments. Slide two, please. We are the nation's first green bank. We were established by a bipartisan act of our legislature in July of 2011. Coalition for Green Capital, which Jeff Shub represents, you'll hear from him soon, helped to establish us by doing consulting work with people in government in Connecticut. We are quasi-public, meaning we are state-sponsored, but with a semi-autonomous governance structure, as you'll see in a moment. We've focused on providing families and businesses with access to the capital they need to finance clean energy improvements to their homes and buildings. To provide that financing, we are supported by a system benefit charge on electric bills that amounts to between $7 and $10 per household per year, or $24 to $26 million annually. We are supported by proceeds from a regional cap and trade program, which provides another $3 million or so to our coffers. Those are our state support resources. We also receive funds from the government on a competitive basis from the Department of Energy or USDA, or through formula allocation, as was the case in 2009 with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds. Jeff Shub will explain to you about the Clean Energy and Sustainability Accelerator Act, which could provide another source of funds for green banks across the nation, like the EIF. Beyond public support, we have a portfolio of assets that, after several years of doing transactions, generates about $8 million in cash flow annually. And we issue green liberty bonds that are purchased by families of Connecticut and citizens of our country. We have another issuance coming up on April 22nd, which is Earth Day. This is the second issuance of green liberty bonds, which are available at a very low denomination of $1,000 per bond. Slide three, please. We have a distinguished board, which you see here. Our board is appointed by a combination of the governor and legislative leaders. We have three ex officio members from the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, the Department of Economic and Community Development, and the office of our state treasurer. So you see that our state government is very much an influence on our board, even though we have independence. To support the governance of the Connecticut Green Bank, we also have four committees, including one which has responsibility for approving transactions which lie above a staff approval threshold. We invite all of you to attend a board meeting of the Green Bank. They're open to the public. They are all virtual these days. Dates and times are on our website, and the next one is next Friday, April 23rd, from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Slide four, please. Jeff Shub will go in more detail about this, but green banks do come in all shapes and varieties and names. Yours would be the EIF. Ours is actually called a green bank. But the point is, the general idea is the same. And that's to leverage limited public resources with multiples of private capital. Each one is formed to address the sustainable energy issues that are relevant to the state or area where the entity is formed. Connecticut's Green Bank was formed to address some key challenges that we have. We have the highest electricity costs for the lowest 48 states in the nation. We have very inefficient building stock. the majority of which is over 50 years old in need of retrofits. We have grid reliability issues. When the Green Bank was established, there were 5 major storms within a 2-year period, and people lost power unacceptably for a long period of time. So resiliency and reliability became an emphasis. Energy diversity, we rely very much on nuclear and natural gas for our electric power. The government wanted to really diversify beyond that concentration. And our government, as many states have the same problem, spending is constrained, there are budget issues, and with all these needs for capital to do sustainability financing, the state had to look to other avenues to promote that that funding. So the Green Bank was established, taking over the existing Clean Energy Fund, which has been around since about the year 2000, and using the fund's revenue stream to fund operations and investments. Slide 5, please. So here you see on this slide how the Green Bank works in 3 distinct ways to bring in private capital. We co-invest in transactions with private capital, usually as a subordinated lender, but sometimes as a senior lender. A subordination of our lending de-risks the transaction somewhat for private capital, makes the investment more attractive by reducing the risk, enhancing returns, or both. In the middle there, you see we offer credit support, most frequently in the form of a loan loss reserve, where we will shoulder a portion of the credit loss of private capital. And on the right, you see we warehouse smaller transactions, aggregating them until the critical size needed for investment is attained, and then we can invite private capital in to participate. Next slide, please. This translates from how the methods we use to participate in the market to our actual programs. So on the left, you see there, Posigen is a solar and energy efficiency company that targets low to moderate income families. The Small Business Energy Advantage program, run by one of our major utilities, sells us and a bank partner the energy efficiency loans that they make to small businesses that allow the contractors to make these investments that these businesses need to be more energy efficient. We also have a program with a community development financial institution, or called a CDFI, which is the low-income multifamily energy or LIME loan. That allows these multifamily properties to improve their financial stability by reducing the amount of revenue spent for heating, air conditioning, or hot water. The picture in the very lower left of the slide, which shows all those solar panels on those buildings, represents how we assist our state and local governments to procure solar for the best purchase price and financing arrangements possible through a 2-step auction process. This is the first of its kind by a Green Bank in the nation, and hopefully will start a trend for more efficiently acquiring solar for government properties. In the middle of the slide, you see how we use our loan loss reserve through a network of banks under our Smarty loan program. We work with credit unions and community banks, and that allows loans for retrofits, as Chris Rose was discussing earlier in his presentation. On the right, our award-winning CPACE program has now completed more than 330 projects statewide. Providing nearly $185 million in public and private financing and avoiding nearly $300 million in energy costs over the life of the projects. We were the first in the country to securitize CPACE loans made for energy efficiency retrofits as well as solar financing. And that process of securitizing those transactions has now been replicated by the private sector. So next slide, please. This is just a slide to remind everyone that we work in partnership with our energy utility partners. It's very important to be in lockstep with them. They provide a number of energy efficiency programs for homeowners, multifamily, small businesses, as well as for state and municipal governments. Slide 8, please. This shows how, after a period of time, we did ramp up. And we have now deployed with the private sector, $2 billion of investment in the Connecticut economy over that eight-year period. And this is money that is actually out the door and into projects. These are not commitments. This is actual money out the door. With a leverage ratio of about $6 to $7 of private capital for every $1 of Green Bank funds invested. There is a range depending on the nature of the transactions, larger projects, which are, you know, big project related type of investments are in the range of 4 to 1, and projects like C-PACE and residential energy efficiency are more in the range of 8 to 10 to 1. Next slide, please. On this slide, we show how working with our partners, we've been successful in driving impact. We have created over 23,000 job years of employment while reducing the burden of energy costs on over 55,000 families and businesses through the deployment of clean energy. We've also helped avoid the emission of nearly 9 million metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions over the life of the projects, and avoided the emissions of local air pollution that is improving the public health of our citizens. I would say if there's anything that is probably overlooked in the benefit of Green Banks, it is the impact on public health as well as the environment. Slide 10, please. This comparative pie chart just shows the major transformation over 8 years that the Green Bank has demonstrated, from $13 million of investments in 2012 to nearly $180 million for the fiscal year ended in 2020. That's a 14-fold increase. Slide 11, please. And this just shows how those loans are allocated across our programs. Like Alaska, we have a commercial PACE program. That's roughly a third of the portfolio of investments. We have commercial solar and energy efficiency programs for businesses. That's about a little bit more than a third. And then we have a residential solar fund, which is now capped, meaning it's no longer doing business because we have transitioned that activity fully to the private sector. That's about a quarter of our portfolio. And then about 10% of the portfolio is made up of what we call grid-tied projects, which are larger projects like wind projects, run-of-river hydro, microgrids, and fuel cell power generation.
Mr. Hunter, next slide, if I could interrupt please. You, Representative Fields has a question.
Yes, sir.
Thanks to the chair. Mr. Hunter, is this breakdown in terms of investments intentional, or was it circumstantial based on opportunity, you know, with about a third between C-PACE, commercial, and residential, with a relatively small amount of money in grid-tied projects?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, yes, it was intentional because in statute we were directed to develop a commercial PACE program, which we did. We were also directed to develop a residential solar program. So, and what we did was, when we took on the effort of the residential solar program, from my personal experience prior to coming to the Green Bank, I knew that commercial solar projects were particularly challenged. So when we established those funds, we made a provision to bring commercial solar projects under the umbrella of that fund. So it was a first of a kind investment proposition ever, and but it really started to open up the market for commercial solar activity in the state. The grid-tied projects, that was not a direct call-out by our statute, so those were more opportunistic transactions, which accounts for the low amount of investment there. But we have developed a portal of open, what we call our Open RFP Capital Solutions Program, so we expect to see more of those transactions in the future. Does that address your question?
Follow-up, Representative Fields?
Yes, it does, and it leads to a follow-up. So as you look back at this experience, in terms of bang for your buck, saving energy and therefore reducing emissions and improving public health, have you achieved bigger bang for your buck in any one of these categories, or are there similar levels of benefit per dollar invested?
That's a very good question. I would say that energy efficiency is probably the biggest bang for the buck, whether it be for commercial businesses, multifamily, or regular household single family homes. The reason is that what you find when you do, in our particular neck of the woods, when you do solar, is only about 10 to 15 or maybe high side 20% of the homes and businesses that are positioned properly to install solar with optimum results. And so, but every building structure can take advantage of energy efficiency. So if you're deploying capital, if you want to reduce energy spend, and you want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, meaning offsetting fuel emissions, then yeah, the best bang for the buck in a program is going to be energy efficiency.
Thank you. And Representative Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. While we're paused for questions, back on slide 8, I think it was, that was where the leveraging graph was, and I noticed a dip in it. And I wanted to ask if there was any learnings that could be had from that. Yeah, it looks like it's slide 8, the leverage ratio. Around 2014, it took a dip. I was wondering, is that just purely economic conditions, or was there anything with the deployment or operation of the program that contributed to that? Thank you.
Sure. Through the chair. Yes, in that particular situation, as I mentioned in my comments, depending upon the transaction, the leverage is lower for larger projects that come on stream, and higher for like our solar fund or energy efficiency, programs like commercial PACE, more broadly, where and our residential energy efficiency program, the Smart E program, where that leverage ratio was 10 to 1. We happen to have some bigger projects that came on stream in 2014, and that really accounted for that drop in leverage, because those big projects pulled the leverage ratio down at that particular point in time. But it's something that we were just getting started. We were just really 2 years in, so we weren't really focusing that on a metric. We were just trying to get transactions done regardless of the leverage at that point. Does that address your question, sir?
Representative Kaufman, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you.
I see no other questions at this time. Please continue.
Okay. So I think we were moving to slide 12. Which is the organizational overview. I just wanted to point out here, this is kind of an organizational overview which shows the various subsidiaries of the Connecticut Green Bank aligned with transactions. So the blue boxes represent legal entities or subsidiaries under the Green Bank, and the gray boxes show financing counterparties, various banks and investors in our products or programs. House Bill 170 enables the Energy Independence Fund to set up subsidiary entities. And I wanted to make clear to the committee to understand that our Green Bank has made great use of these entities, and they're very necessary to protect the cash flows for investors. And that's why this type of a structure enables entities like the EIF to leverage funds so dramatically, because the investors gain confidence that the cash flows are going to be available to them to repay the obligations of the EIF. Are there any questions about that point?
I see no questions at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Next slide, slide 13. This just shows what's essential about the Green Bank model is that the public sector mobilizes more private investment in the green economy. We've drawn in over $800 million in private capital in particular facilities. These are some of them that are represented here. What I want to point out is that we've worked with just about every conceivable investor or lender in the market, credit unions, community banks, CDFIs, private equity, major global banks, insurance companies, REITs. And keep in mind, you know, we're not California. We're not New York. We're Connecticut. Population 3.5 million, GDP of about 300 billion. So that just gives you an idea that this market is attractive regardless of size, and the investment community will make their way to Alaska to invest in these transactions, in addition to the local investment dollars that are available as well. Next slide.
Representative Fields has a question.
I guess it just, sure. I guess it just strikes me that most of these project amounts are higher than the current $20 million threshold in HB 170. And I don't know if you have a thought on if we're going to limit the size, what should it be, or maybe should we just not limit it at all?
Well, I think it's important to start somewhere. I think that it's important to realize that I think that the EIF will be a success. I think that the gentleman Alan Weitzner gave a presentation on how the sizing was done for the EIF, and I think it's a good place to start. But I think that the EIF will be successful and is likely to grow substantially, just as the Connecticut Green Bank did. Yeah, obviously there our situations are a bit different. I think the composition of your portfolio could well be different, particularly when you look at some rural opportunities, rural Alaskan opportunities, and the indigenous communities as well that need the native communities that need assistance with energy efficiency, or rather energy hybrid energy models and things of that sort, and resiliency. But I think it's important to start somewhere. I think the $10 million that it has been pegged in the bill, I believe that's the amount, is certainly a suitable place to start. But you should expect it to grow.
Follow-up, Representative Fields?
I guess I meant the $20 million cap that's currently in the bill for project size. Is it, in your view, is it necessary to have a cap on project size? And, you know, it just looks like a lot of these projects are substantially higher than that. I meant the cap versus the capitalization.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't understand that part of your question. So the projects, our project sizes actually are generally well below $20 million. These are capital facilities generally. There are a few transactions that represent facility, actual projects, like a fuel cell project. Two fuel cell projects were in the vicinity of, one was $40 million, another one was $60 million. There was a wind project that was about $25 million. But those were rather rare in terms of the number of projects. Most of the projects, I think, that the EIF will undertake will be probably $2 million or less.
And Mr. Hunter, I was actually going to ask Mr. Weitzner to jump on, but I actually saw he just raised his hand, so we're thinking the same thing. If you'd like to provide some input on this, Mr. Weitzner.
Through the chair, thank you very much. What I would like to clarify based on the question is the reference cap in this case is a cap on ADA's guarantee at $20 million. And it's not a project cap in this case. And the legislation with that language in place really is the incentive to be working with private sector together on the projects, and really limits, in this case, the state's involvement in any individual project. It does represent the limits that we have in place as an institution providing that guarantee, subject to then ultimately legislative approval for a larger project. But it is not a cap on the size of the individual project itself.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weitzner. Mr. Hunter, if you could proceed with your presentation. Thank you.
Sure. So going to slide 14 now, where we have our investor relations slide. That's just to indicate that's where you can find information on our Green Liberty bonds. They are quite popular. Our first issuance was last year for $17 million. This year we're back with a $23 million or so issuance. And previously in 2019, we issued roughly $40 million of asset-backed securities, related securities. So in 2 years, we'll have issued $80 million of bonds. It's just to give you an idea of the power of the capital markets to be able to bring capital to Alaska. Next slide, please.
Representative Fields has another question.
Thank you. Who's buying these bonds? Are these kind of patriotic individuals, or is it more institutional investors? Thank you.
Through the chair, the answer is both. We structured the bond with a purchase price of lower than usual, about $1,000 per bond. And we had very substantial retail, so-called mom-and-pop investors buy these bonds. But on the second day, we also had substantial institutional buyers of the bonds. It roughly broke down to about 35% retail and 65% institutional.
Wonderful. Thank you. Please proceed.
Slide 15, just to point out that the bonds were very well recognized in the investment community. We received three awards. You see there, two from Environmental Finance Magazine, including Asset-Backed Bond of the Year, which was amazing given it was our first bond, and from Bond Buyer Magazine for Innovative Bond of the Year for our first Green Liberty bond. That concludes the presentation. Happy to take any more questions or pass it on to the next presenter.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Can you speak to the interest rates for the variety of projects that are within the portfolio in terms of where they were when the Green Bank initially began and as you've matured, where they've also maybe gone to? And I know that there might be external economic factors that play into that, but can you speak a little bit to the interest rates and where you have found the sweet spot to be to ensure that there's participation?
Okay, through the chair. So with our residential product, the Smart E product, we entered that market with the idea, and I think I would come back to what Chris Rose was speaking about earlier, in terms of car loans. We felt that these loans should demonstrate a loss rate of approximately the same as car loans. So we approached the lenders with the idea that we would provide a loan loss reserve and get them to reduce their interest rate for these unsecured loans, but given the fact that they were to homeowners, that they presented a low risk in terms of default. We were correct in that assessment, but the loss reserve allowed us to bring that interest rate, which was ranging it for unsecured loans in the 9 to 14% range, down to the 4 to 6% range. Those interest rates have remained stable, even though other interest rates generally have fallen. And what we have our interest rates set as not to exceed rates, and certain financial institutions have actually dropped their rates below what are not to exceed rates for the program. In terms of our commercial energy efficiency loan in our CPACE program, we started out at around 6% for a 20-year loan. We actually increased that to 6.25%. We have not dropped that 20-year benchmark rate. And if you have a shorter maturity, it drops down to about 5% for a 10-year deal. But what we've discovered is the Green Bank can actually, we have the power to lend at even lower rates. But if we lend at rock bottom rates, we will chase private capital out of the market. So we're trying to find that sweet spot of balance where we keep the private capital players in the market involved, but we also provide some market discipline by understanding what's a reasonable rate of return for the risk. And so we seem to have struck that balance because the private capital players are kind of coming in line and even coming slightly under us from time to time on our interest rates.
Final follow-up.
Representative Zukoski.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Mr. Hunter. And are the loan products typically fixed or variable interest rate?
They are fixed rate.
Wonderful. Thank you. Representative Klayman.
In terms of the loans that you have out, there's been some question periodically on a national level about how accessible the loans are to people of lower economic means. And certainly when you get more commercial investment, that tends not to be folks with lower economic means. How is the placement of these loans appearing in people that may be more financially challenged?
We actually have good experience with that in a couple of respects. With our Smart eLoan program, where we provide a loan loss reserve, we actually set up the program to allow for less than what are generally called prime borrowers, which are about the 680 and up category. We actually dropped our entry point for a second class of borrower down to 640. But in return for the lenders agreeing to go into that lower tier, we doubled our loan loss reserve rate. So, but we also constrained the ability of the lenders to lend and go too aggressively into that market as a percentage of their portfolio. But we did it based on statistics that we researched in the market, and that never ended up being a limiting factor of going after that market. Then as the lenders got more used to lending in that lower tier, they actually approached us and asked us if we would lower down to 580 what we would be willing to do with the same loss reserve. And we said, absolutely. They knew their borrowers, and they're very close to them, and they recognized there were some circumstances where there were lower-tier borrowers that wanted to come into the market. But we also recognize that lower income does not necessarily translate into poor credit. So we actually opened up the market to that lower credit sphere by inviting credit unions and community banks that actually tend to a wide range of income demographics. The second thing I would say is that, if you recall, I mentioned a company called Posigen. They do solar and energy efficiency for primarily low and moderate income families. They do that through an alternative credit underwrite. And so by our partnership with them, we have actually been able to open up to less than 100% area median income. Those families that are below that median income. And so now we're kind of what we call solar parity, where there's an equal number of families that are getting solar above that level as well as below that level. So that's been a very big success for us.
Representative Klayman?
Are there any statutory requirements that the legislature put in place that required you to loan, to be pursuing lending are there legislative requirements in terms of your being involved in lower income borrowers?
Through the chair, no, there isn't a legislative requirement, but it is part of our comprehensive plan that we gets approved by our board. So we actually adjusted our comprehensive plan about 5 years ago to specifically open the market to lower income families, because we discovered in looking at the types of transactions we were doing up to that date that we were not reaching that community. And so we said we wanted to make a public statement about our desire to reach those communities.
Thank you.
Representative Fields?
Thanks, through the chair, Mr. Hunter. the fund, it looks like the fund has grown a lot, and I see that you have infusions of cash from the REGI market and from fees that homeowners pay. In the absence of those funding sources, how much would the fund have grown?
I've never really been asked that question. It's a great question. I would say that it would have been more challenging, much more challenging, given that we were the first green bank. But I would, because we needed to demonstrate to the market a lot of things. Being the first, we had to demonstrate that these loans were good investments for the private sector to put their money to. We started the first solar loans, for instance, that were not secured by a lien on the home. So we brought that product to market. That market is now a more than $1 billion market that is led by the likes of Mosaic. So we opened up that market. And it's one of those things where we had to actually demonstrate, since we had to demonstrate to private capital, we had to put 100% of the funds behind many of those transactions, or a higher level initially than we would if we were starting fresh today, like the EIF. So the EIF can actually look at green banks, like Connecticut, like New York, like Rhode Island, like Montgomery County, and see the benefits that we have had in terms of leveraging capital. There have been a number of other private capital, as well as co-venturing funds that have been put together. So this is not new ground at this point. This is well established, and there's been a lot of research on the type of loans that have been made by green banks and similar organizations.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I guess just thinking about what's similar and what's different, Alaska vis-a-vis Connecticut. We aren't in REGI. We don't have these fees, and I'm just trying to think about how do we grow the fund to make investments at the scale that we need. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Representative Fields, and thank you very much, Mr. Hunter. With that, we are going to go to our final invited testifier, Mr. Jeff Shube, the Executive Director of the Coalition for Green Capital. My apologies if I pronounced your last name incorrectly. Thank you for being with us today. If you could please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Great. Thank you so much for the opportunity to join this discussion today. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Shub, and I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for Green Capital. As Chris said up at the top, I've had the pleasure of taking a trip up to Anchorage from my home here in northern New Jersey, pretty far away, but glad to be able to join you by video. I've had the pleasure of working with Chris and others in Alaska for almost 7 years now, developing green bank proposals and exploring the opportunity, so really thrilled to be able to speak in support of this bill. Next slide, please. So for background, the Coalition for Green Capital is a nonprofit charitable organization that works around the U.S. and increasingly around the world to help develop and support and launch green bank mission-driven clean energy finance institutions like the one proposed in Alaska. We work with government, we work with market participants, we work with capital providers and other key stakeholders to understand what the opportunities are, what the investment needs are, and design policy and institutions that can ultimately fit this need and drive positive economic activity in these local markets. We are currently working in over a dozen states in the United States. Our work has led to a collective $5 billion or so of clean energy investment in those markets. And we're an organization of about 20 people working mostly around the U.S., but increasingly around the rest of the country as well. Next slide, please. So I want to speak a little bit about the landscape of what this model is doing around the country, what the impacts have been, and where activity is happening. This financing model of the proposed Energy Independence Fund is not novel or new anymore. Rather, after a decade of demonstration and implementation across the U.S., this model of green banks is now proven and repeatable. Cumulatively, these institutions drove over $5 billion of investment through 2019, and though the latest numbers are not yet published, I know that through 2020, that number rose to over $7 billion of investment, where on average there's three private dollars being leveraged or mobilized for every public dollar deployed by a green bank. As you obviously just heard, plenty of statistics about the very successful Connecticut Green Bank, the first green bank in the country, in the amount of investment that they've driven through this model. This is based on market principles, and so every project that is being financed is derived from some form of consumer demand, either because the project will save the customer money, will make their home or building more comfortable, or because it will make their community more resilient. This is a market-based approach to driving investment into solutions that make people better off, create jobs, and support communities. And they have done this with a particular focus on serving low-income and underserved communities that are often left out or left behind in a clean energy transition. As Bert said, sometimes this is driven by statute, sometimes it's driven simply because that is where there is an opportunity to fill a gap. And so green banks have developed quite a track record for doing this. Next slide, please. This is a map showing the spread of this model across the country. And as this shows, the financial model is spreading irrespective of politics. In any state, it turns out, using limited public funds efficiently to drive more private sector activity is broadly appealing. And just as Alaska's energy needs are different from, say, Florida's or New York's, the Energy Independence Fund in Alaska would finance projects and drive economic activity that's tailored to this state. So the model itself is the core underlying principle, but in every single case, these institutions have different strategies are targeting different markets, and as was alluded to previously, often have different names. In the case of Connecticut, it's literally called a green bank, although in many states these aren't literally called green banks. So in all situations, they are tailored to fit the local market and local policy conditions. Next slide, please.
Representative Rauscher has a question.
Thank you, Chairman Scharge. For the speaker, I was just wondering, you have blue, you have green, you have gray. Existing, I understand, in development, is that in development of state law, or is that in development of the green banks themselves, I guess?
So what that's a good question. What that represents is either there is some official government action that has been taken, for example, the proposal of legislation, or there is an effort underway with a group of actors often acting in coordination with government to develop and explore the creation of a green bank. So for example, in the state of South Carolina, there has not been a proposed legislation, but that state's energy office issued a report that recommended the creation of a green bank. And so our nonprofit is now collaborating with that energy office and with local stakeholders to design and develop a proposal for a green bank. So that's another example of a state green bank being under development.
Follow-up, Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, I was just wondering if we could find some numbers on what's actually out there as far as state legislation that has already been passed as versus state banks, I mean, banks that are actually being formed. I'd appreciate it if you could do that. Thank you.
And Mr. Shubb, if you could send that to the chairman, we'll get that to all committee members. And I don't see any other questions at this time, so please proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you. On next slide, please. So specifically in Alaska, our organization has had the opportunity to get to know the market opportunity, specifically partnering with Municipality of Anchorage, the Alaska Conservation Foundation, and REAP to do a deep dive assessment of the opportunity for and need for green bank investment in Anchorage. This process included extensive interviews with market participants, analysis of data sources, and a review of existing policies and programs. And the outcome of this work was a recommended set of investments, specifically with a focus on small-scale solar, residential heating and electric efficiency, and commercial building upgrades using C-PACE financing. And this, I just pointed this as an example of the kind of analytical work that's been done already to demonstrate the opportunity here. And really, though, this just serves as a kernel of what can be done statewide through this financing mechanism, as the energy and investment needs required in more rural or remote communities are certainly different than those required in Anchorage. Next slide, please. Now, zooming out to the national level, Alaska and Governor Dunleavy have chosen the exact right time to consider this policy because Congress is now getting closer to enacting complementary federal policy that will create a new national entity with a specific job of providing capital to the Alaska Energy Independence Fund. There is now bipartisan legislation to create what is called the Clean Energy and Sustainability Accelerator, a $100 billion national green bank to fund state entities like the ones proposed today. Critically, Alaska's Representative Don Young is a co-sponsor of this bill, so this is a bipartisan bill. There's also been strong support from this bill from key Alaska stakeholders, including Alaska Power and Telephone and Sea Alaska Corporation. On Monday of this week, a letter of support was sent to Congress urging the passage of this policy, which was signed by nearly 250 businesses, capital providers, trade groups, organizations, and utilities. This legislation passed the full House of Representatives twice last year. And just 2 weeks ago, the accelerator policy was expressly endorsed by the president and included in his proposed infrastructure package. This model has proliferated across the country with bipartisan support, and we are extremely grateful to both Representative Young and the governor for the leadership they are showing on this issue and for continuing that track record of bipartisanship in support of the Green Bank model. Next slide, please. The accelerator's funds would be eligible for investment in a very broad swath of sectors, which would then give the Energy Independence Fund the flexibility to invest in Alaska according to the need. For example, renewable power and storage for remote communities, or energy efficiency to reduce consumption in energy bills in buildings, or investment in climate resilience would all be eligible for investment with the funds provided from this new National Green Bank. Next slide, please. And finally, as I alluded to earlier, investment from the National Green Bank could be used for targeted investment into disadvantaged and underserved communities. This is particularly important in Alaska with remote communities and native communities that can typically be left out of the economic development opportunity. And nationally, this is all too often a problem for those who might be off the grid or have low income, pay the highest energy burden due to high energy bills. But with the Energy Independence Fund and funding support from the National Accelerator, there would be a dedicated pot of funds to ensure that investment is directed into those communities in order to alleviate those challenges. On the next slide, just wanted to say thank you again for the opportunity and really thank Alaska for your leaders at the state and national level for standing up and supporting this policy in order to drive smart and efficient investment into Alaska to lower energy costs, create new jobs, and support economic development. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And Representative Fields has a question.
Thanks to the chair. Weatherizing individual homes obviously would have a lot of transaction costs. What do you see as successful models in terms of aggregating weatherization investments for single family or, you know, not particularly large multifamily homes so you get that scale without too much time and money wasted talking with individual homeowners?
It's a good question through the chair. There's a number of strategies for attacking this. In some cases, this is about enabling and empowering the individual retail lenders to make those loans rather than having the Green Bank make them directly. So in the case of, you know, Connecticut or Michigan that run standardized centralized loan loss reserve programs that enable the lenders themselves to directly make residential energy efficiency loans, but they do so while also providing complementary support to try to lower those transaction costs. So for example, the Green Bank helps train and organize contractors and educate them on the financial product and similarly inform the bank themselves to understand what the programmatic structure is, so that it's not relying purely on a hope and a prayer that the contractor finds the right lender and that this all works. The Green Bank is behind the scenes actually making that market work and coordinating these partners in order specifically to reduce those transaction costs. That's a really key piece of this. As Bert related earlier, there are also cases where Green Banks are directly originating those loans themselves, aggregating them into a warehouse, and then selling them on the back end, either selling the loans entirely or selling them as asset-backed securities. So there's a number of different ways to alleviate the transaction cost problem, but you're definitely right that that is a barrier. And this sort of goes to one of the first questions around the perceived risk or why is the cost of financing a solar project high. I think definitely part of it is newness and a perceived risk, but ultimately this doesn't actually come down to technology risk. A lot of this has to do with, human institutional factors where a lender is simply unfamiliar with this technology and unfamiliar with how to underwrite certain kinds of transactions to clean energy projects. And so it requires more time and effort by a loan officer to actually evaluate that loan. That's a cost to that lender, and the way they recover their costs is through a higher interest rate. And so part of this is just about getting more experience into those lenders so that they don't look at this as a burden to try to understand what that loan opportunity is. But part of the capital cost also is definitely the lack of a secondary market where that lender doesn't want to be held holding that paper for 10 or 15 years where they can't do anything with the money. And then if they knew they had an off-taker who would buy those transactions, then they'd be much more comfortable making loans and doing so at lower interest rates. So part of this is about building familiarity and comfort with individual lenders, but this is also very much about building the overall financial infrastructure behind the scenes, so to speak, to help capital flow more at a lower cost and more quickly.
Representative Fields, follow-up?
Only 8% of the Kinetic Green Bank loans were for grid-tied projects. Are you seeing the proportion of Green Bank loans to grid-tied projects increasing as the cost of new generation has fallen so dramatically, or is the ratio that we saw with the Connecticut Green Bank typical across Green Banks?
It's a good question. I would say it's typical that the percentage is fairly low, which is derived from two things. One, most Green Banks don't have an enormous amount of capital at the state level, which again is a lot of the motivation for the federal policy. If you have $50 million to finance a large grid-tied project, that might be tens of millions of dollars. You could just end up using your entire capital base on a single grid-tied project, and so it's not sort of efficient or wise from a capital deployment perspective. But a lot of this is also derived from what the actual financing needs are in certain markets where, let's just take an extreme example of a, grid-tied utility scale solar project. Those projects tend to be pretty financeable on commercial terms. They don't need public financial support in this form. That said, this really does vary and depend on the geography and the energy needs of a state. So for example, in the case of New York State, the New York Green Bank finances a large amount of community solar projects, which are effectively large to medium-sized ground-mounted solar that is fed into the grid, and it's effectively a virtual or collective net metering structure through regulation, because it happens to be the case in New York that there's a lot of farmland and there's a lot of space to build those projects, and the state just has a large power need. So ultimately, the answer will depend on the state-specific energy needs and the financial capabilities of that Green Bank.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do other committee members have questions for Mr. Shub? Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shub, Alaska settled its indigenous land claims quite differently than the lower 48, and in some circumstances, there might be an individual Alaskan that owns a home in their community where the community has not transferred land claims under that home over to the individual per se. We call it 14C3 land conveyance, I believe. In terms of Green Bank, and maybe this is a question for both you and Chris Rose, since I know this is a highly specific Alaska question, does that particular land status under an individual's home put at risk the ability for, say, an individual to participate in a residential loan program available through the Green Bank?
So I'll take a stab at it, and then we'll definitely hand it to Chris. In the case of a unsecured energy efficiency loan for the project, I don't think that would be a problem. If we were talking about a structure that was somehow tied to the property rights or a mortgage or the tax, like a tax lien based financing, then that might get complicated. But sort of a straight unsecured energy efficiency loan, I don't think that would be problematic. But Chris, you've probably looked into this certainly more than I have.
And Mr. Rose, if you could please address the question as well.
Through the chair, I agree with Mr. Shub. If there's not a lien on the property, then I think it would be less important to a local participant lender because they're not trying to get a lien on the property if the program is based on an unsecured loan.
Thank you.
Do other committee members have questions for Mr. Shub?
Not. I do have another question.
Oh, Representative, for Mr. Shub?
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Getting back to this idea of transaction costs and scale for residential weatherization, when you see these programs in practice, what is the scale? Are entities getting a loan to weatherize 10 homes, 100 homes, 10,000 homes? I'd just like to understand how it works on the ground.
So, I mean, in some cases, it's individual loan by loan. So, for example, that loan loss reserve product I referred to that a number of states like Connecticut and Michigan use, that's, you know, an individual contractor is developing a project in an individual home, and they're going to an individual bank to get a loan for that project, where that bank has a credit risk mitigation provided by risk mitigation provided by the Green Bank. Some of those banks have done hundreds and hundreds of loans, and Bert would have the specific data on that in Connecticut. In other states like New York, the New York Green Bank operates more as a wholesale provider of capital, more often so the New York Green Bank is providing a loan to a developer or specialty finance company, which then turns around and does actually finance lots of individual homes, which in those cases, I think those examples are often in the cases of certainly hundreds, if not thousands of homes that are being targeted with those funds.
Interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions from Mr. Shub, I want to thank you for your presentation. We are now that concludes invited testimony. We're now going to go back to Mr. Alan Weitzner, who is online for questions, and I believe those who are able to stay online will do so to answer questions as those come up as well. Are there questions for Mr. Weitzner?
Or Rose.
Or Mr. Rose. Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weitzner, we heard from Mr. Hunter about the sweet spot of lending with respect to interest rates being between 4% to 6%. In order to continue sustained interest from the private sector, but to also make it accessible to lower income lenders and to incentivize public participation. Can you speak to Ada's thoughts on the goal of the interest rate that you're looking to pursue with respect to an Alaska program?
Through the chair, Representative Zolkowski, what I would identify is the fact that I do believe that through benchmarking with best practices, that we'll be able to identify the programs that work best within Alaska's unique energy requirements. One of the benefits of working through ADA, I believe in this case, is we have approached it the same way with one of our other existing programs that has been very successful, ultimately in supporting commercial real estate development within the state, and that's the Loan Participation Program, which is really structured to provide long-term fixed rate, cost-effective capital for Alaska. So we would be approaching it the same way. The specific price point we need to get determined in how we're working with the financial sector and how it ultimately, I believe, engages the largest amount that we can with programs for the underlying development projects, sustainable development projects. So the intent, the target certainly is to get to that type of price point. We're looking for that advice coming through from these benchmark, other successful, in this case references Green Banks, and how that can be applied specifically for Alaska.
Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that when the governor introduced the legislation, he had indicated a goal of 5%, and Mr. Hunter in his testimony said 4% to 6%. Is that a goal that ADA is looking to attain?
Through the chair, Representative Zolkowski, certainly. And again, identifying if that's that right interest rate level that gets the largest involvement, gets the greatest value, the efficiency, in this case energy efficiency or solar panel or other type of sustainable energy development programs in place, certainly.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. If Chris Rose is still online, I had a question.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thanks, Chris. How do you see this playing out in terms of home weatherization? You know, it seems like in recent years we've had neighbors pooling together to do a neighborhood scale rooftop solar installation. Do you see rural cap in being involved in a, you know, in kind of a larger way, or how do you see this working for home weatherization and potentially rooftop solar? Thank you.
Through the chair, well, as Mr. Shub just pointed out, there, at least in New York, there's been a couple of ways to do it. There's both the individual person who may want to take out a loan rather than a grant. And in the past, we saw 50,000 homes take grants. I would hope that a program could be attractive enough for an individual to be able to participate. But as Mr. Shub said, it's also possible that a contractor, if they see a big enough business opportunity, could potentially take advantage of a program if it was designed that way, to borrow a larger amount of money and then refinance that to his or her clients. So I guess it's possible that you could see a business develop that would take advantage of a Green Bank program, or in this case, the AKEIF program, and then redistribute that money through loans. So I would hope that either way might be facilitated, but certainly the individual for sure.
Representative Klayman.
This is for Mr. Weitzler. In the proposed legislation, there's an advisory board that's looking at the Green Bank loans, and then, but it appears that the ADA board still has final authority, and the advisory board's role is purely advisory. What's ADA's experience working with advisory boards?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman. We don't have exactly established advisory boards for any of our other programs. That has been determined really directly by ADA's board. But in this case, what we're looking at is what was benchmarked with through the our sister agency, the Alaska Energy Authority, and particularly the Renewable Energy Fund. There was an advisory board that was established there that gives input ultimately on the different projects, programs that they're undertaking as projects are being proposed through their funding, and that was a grant funding process. So what we're looking to do is in this legislation is establish a similar advisory board that would provide that input and structure the different programs, but ultimately it would require approval by ADA's board, which is its general corporate governance.
Follow up?
Representative Klayman.
You refer to the Energy Authority as a sister organization. Can you describe a little bit more that relationship? Is that got a totally separate board from ADA, or tell me a little bit more about the relationship?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, for that clarification, because what I would highlight is that there is a common board that exists between ADA and the Alaska Energy Authority. They are independent boards, however, they are the same parties that are involved between our board and the Alaska Energy Authority. In this case, it's seven representatives each, two identified by commissioners within the administration, being the Commissioner of the Department of Commerce and the Commissioner of Revenue, Department of Revenue. And then we have five independent private sector participants on the board.
Follow up. Representative Klayman.
And you're saying that they're the same seven people on both boards?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, yes, sir, they are.
Are you follow up?
Representative Klayman.
What's the tends to be the practice with the Energy Authority between recommendations from the advisory board and decisions by the board? Do they tend to follow those recommendations, or do they often disagree with the advisory board's recommendations?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I'm not aware of any disagreement that's in place between what is in that specific reference of a committee and the actions of the Alaska Energy Authority. It is an advisory committee in that capacity and looking at the different projects, and those decisions are taken at with the Alaska Energy Authority staff in the applications of those grants. What I would identify is that the ADA's board is in support of this legislation. We passed a resolution actually last night with ADA's board meeting. So I believe that there's consensus on the roles that are envisioned within the legislature, or within the legislation that's being proposed, with the role of the committee or advisory board in this case, and ultimately the adoption of this specific program.
I have a question.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair, Mr. Weitzner. as I recall, you know, we had this period when we made grant-funded investments in renewable energy projects throughout rural Alaska. Then as the amount of money flowing into the REF declined, there was still enough money to sort of test some potential sites, for example, for applicability of wind generation. So if this bill were to pass, it seems like we're going to have some sites where it seems like wind generation, for example, might work. So for such sites, will it be incumbent on a local government to go back and try to put a project together, or are AEA and ADA going to kind of proactively review that data and try to help assist communities in putting together projects where it seems they might be viable, but, you know, grant funding dried up before they were able to be deployed?
I apologize. Please repeat the question. It was the internet connection was back and forth.
It looks like that is an internet issue on our end, so if we give it just a moment, brief at ease. Back on the record, let's try that now, although it looks like the internet connection is fading in and out. Representative Fields, would you try repeating your question?
Mr. Weitzner, can you hear me now?
Mr. Chairman, I can. And what I would advise you to, Mr. Chairman, is that I do have a colleague of mine, our Chief Investment Officer, Morgan Neff, is on by phone. So if we're not able to address this through the internet connection, should be able to still, if you want to present a question to him.
Sure, I'll ask Morgan. So the question is, my understanding is that during the period when the legislature robustly funded REF, the state deployed a bunch of renewable energy projects across rural Alaska. As REF monies declined, AEA's wind program still had enough resources to go out and basically test different sites for the feasibility of wind generation. So now I think we have a bunch of sites where potentially wind generation could work. And my question is, if this bill passes, will AEA and ADA sort of go back and proactively review these sites and try to help put projects together, help put project financing together, or is it going to be incumbent on those local communities to do all that legwork? Thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, I believe this is Morgan Neff, Chief Investment Officer of ADA. That is the value proposition with partnering up with AEA alongside ADA's investment management process and guidelines, is that that will be a proactive outreach program as they currently serve 197 communities in rural Alaska, you know, through various of their programs, and they have a phenomenal engineering and project management expertise that we'll be able to leverage alongside the loan program in order identifying energy sustainable projects.
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. And I'd like to tag on a question of my own, if I may. So speaking to the prioritization of projects, I know that with a capitalization of just $10 million, there's certainly not enough to do everything that we'd like to do with this independent energy fund. What is the criteria for prioritizing the various investments that could be made? Is it solely based on the return on investment, or is that process still to be determined? Can you speak to that, please, Mr. Weitzner?
Certainly. What I would address is that's where I really see the importance of this advisory board, is identifying the particular programs that do get the attention. The $10 million in capitalization, again, is the initial capitalization. The intention is to build it like the example that was given by Mr. Hunter with the Connecticut Green Bank. And really, we've drawn a lot of inspiration from the exceptional work that Mr. Hunter has done there with Connecticut's Green Bank, and being able to really identify the different programs that have the most application, the broadest application to address Alaska's unique energy needs. I think everyone would recognize the fact that each of the processes and approaches that are by these different types of funds for sustainable energy, clean energy development, is really a local process, and really getting that local input on what the best program should be and how they're structured. So I do see a principal component being that advisory board and that input and then how we ultimately structure the best financing programs to be able to really implement them and to be used. I think across the board, all of us want this to be as successful as Mr. Hunter has been with the Connecticut Green Bank.
Thank you, Mr. Weissner. Are there other questions from committee members? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we have ADA board passing a resolution, is that equivalent to Alaska Energy Authority also passing a resolution?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, no, it's not. They are independent boards. So a resolution would need to be separately presented within the Alaska Energy Authority and adopted by the board. The reason that there's a resolution in place for the Alaska Energy or for ADA in this case is that we had a presentation on this Alaska Energy Independent Fund yesterday, and the board really wanted to express its full support.
Follow up.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I heard correctly, the ADA board has the same makeup as the Alaska Energy Authority board. However, it's made up of different people. Is that correct?
Same people.
Through the chair, no, it's not correct. These are the same board members that are on ADA's board and AEA's board. We are definitionally separate authorities, so there are designated separate boards. They do happen to be the same people.
So if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
So it would be the same people making the same decision on a very similar resolution. So how would they, why would you have to go through on a whole nother process of approving a resolution if it's the exact same people making the exact same decision?
Through the chair, Representative Buck, the authorities are by definition within statute different authorities with boards that, if you're asking about the Alaska Energy Authority passing a resolution, it would need to be done during an AEA board meeting.
Representative Tuck, would you like another follow-up?
Just government at its best. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do other committee members have questions? Representative Klayman.
Mr. Weissler, I have a couple of questions about the fiscal note. The first was just, looks like a fair number of folks getting hired for this. How did you come up with a number of people on the cost assumptions on the fiscal note?
Through the chair, thank you very much for that question, because what we did was we also benchmarked internally on our successful programs, and what we relate this quite a bit to is what we've been able to accomplish within the state on the loan participation program, and we see this having the same level of success and sizing. Once we have the initial capitalization, we're able to engage leverage capital with the local financial institutions, and hopefully have some increased funding that's coming from the federal side with the federal legislation. So in that, in anticipation and with the amount of work necessary in establishing these programs, we looked at what we have staffing-wise for the loan participation program and duplicated that through the management of the Alaska Energy Independence Fund.
Representative Klayman, do you have a follow-up?
Couple more follow-ups.
Go ahead and proceed with that line of questioning.
On the service cost, there's subscriptions at about $10,000 a year. I'm just wondering what subscriptions you need that you don't already subscribe to. It seems like these are the sorts of things you should be in already.
Through the chair, I would like to ask my colleague, the Morgan Neff, to address that point, please.
Through the chair, this is Morgan Neff, Chief Investment Officer, VEDA. Those subscriptions particularly relate to specific energy sustainability and clean energy type databases where we can develop and monitor best practices, not only from a deployment but also a reporting perspective.
And then follow up on the couple of lines down, there's an IT consultant contract. Is that thought to be just a one-year expenditure, or is that going to be an ongoing, every year you're going to need that much IT assistance?
Through the chair, I'd like to take that initially, but then also ask for input from our chief investment officer. We've worked together ultimately in how we're looking to structure this program. The initial input here it really relates to some of the successes that we had, we actually with the AK CARES program. When in the midst of engaging on that, ADA ultimately developed a portal specifically to receive the applications. And what we're looking to do is extend that as well in the implementation of this fund and the administration of the fund. So we do see that there's a higher IT component in the way that the interaction is between the fund itself and the users of that fund, and then the way that we're actually to engage digitally with the financial institutions. So we're really more or less looking to upscale our own operations to match the financial services aspect of this fund and use of this fund. But we'd also like to ask Morgan Neff to add to that.
Through the chair, this is Morgan Neff again. For avoidance of doubt, I also want to point out that the bill contains two fiscal notes, one for the initial capitalization of $10 million and then the operating expense fiscal note that you're currently reviewing. The operating expenses are really tied to the fund being a self-sufficient entity where the returns of the fund will more than offset the proposed expenses. So it's really a fiscal note tied to approving an expansion of ADA's current budget in order to incorporate operating expenses. But we have designed this to be a self-sufficient entity in the fact that it will cover those operation expenses due to from the returns of the fund. And then additionally, it will be there to also receive and manage potential federal appropriations through the Act that could come in the form of additional capital to be deployed at the Green Bank or operational capital used to subsidize operating expenses with the Alaska Energy Independence Fund. Thank you.
Representative Klayman, do you have further follow-up on that?
Just one. On the IT consultant, it sounds like there's ongoing IT needs, and that's in other portions of ADA, and I would query where's the point at which with different interests going on, where does it make more sense to have somebody in-house to do your IT, even though they may be kind of serving different portions of ADA, so there's some shared costs among different branches. Where's the point at which it makes more sense to have somebody in-house rather than do this with outside contractors that maybe you pay a lot more per hour?
Through the chair, we have a limited number of PCNs that we're working with, and ultimately we're looking to add with the PCNs that we're proposing, we're really looking to add that to be focused mostly on the marketing and the engagement on the programs, so the utilization of the programs. We see more efficiency and the limited expenses that are related to elements like IT that we would contract separately and be able to control the costs that way. So that's why we proposed it through the legislation and through the fiscal notes that way.
Representative Klayman, one more follow-up before I go to Representative Fields.
I would just note that really isn't responsive to my question. My question is that we all see an increasing need for IT support. We see it in the legislature. We see it, countless small businesses that eventually they realize they need their own in-house IT. So you've got this list as a contract line rather than another PCN. And I'm raising the question is, where did you look at the question about is ADA as a larger whole with this, assuming this legislation passes and you have this additional responsibility, where is the point at which it makes sense to have an in-house IT person that can work both for ADA? It sounds like the sister organization, the Alaska Energy Authority, with seven identical board members and also here. I just question the assumption that it actually is efficient to use a contractor where you may do much better to have somebody that is in-house that can address the needs of the entire organization. My query is, have you looked at that as an option?
Through the chair, I would answer that not directly. What we did in the analysis is looking at what the ultimate costs are and what the needs were, at least initially in setting up the different programs and having the online access portals, as it was described before. And we had solved that issue externally with external contracts, and we were looking to duplicate the same way with the approach on the Alaska Independence Energy Fund.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair. Mr. Weitzner, a little different line of questions. It was interesting to hear from the Connecticut Green Bank that fund is constantly growing, both as a result of internal returns, but also because of a fee that consumers pay, and also because of income through the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative market. It seems like, as envisioned by this bill, the growth of the fund will be limited to returns from the initial capitalization and from any kind of one-time shot of money from a prospective Jobs Act. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
Okay. So I guess my follow-up question would be,
follow-up, Representative Fields.
Have you contemplated You know, if we were going to add an ongoing source of investment to grow the fund beyond a rate of, you know, internal rate of return, what potential vehicles should we consider?
Well, through the chair, what I would say is that with the legislation that has been proposed, that we're allowed to provide or receive additional capital into the fund and for it to grow through other means. When we're talking about the initial capitalization, the initial purpose, and where that funding is that we're seeing today, those are those sources. But the legislation is actually very flexible in the way that we can continue to receive additional capitalization from many other sources, including philanthropic sources, as they get involved ultimately in the different programs. So there is incremental growth that is within the legislation.
And I'm going to go to Representative Tuck now.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So I'm just curious on why this program would need to be able to have the opportunity to deviate from a prudent investor rule or traditional institutional financing criteria? And do other states, do they have to give up the prudent rule and that criteria?
Through the chair, the reason what we have that is the way that we're applying the different programs, that it's not being established as if we're asset managers or the permanent fund in this case, looking at alternative securities that we're investing in. We're actually creating programs, looking at loans that is the form of the investment. It could also include, through the guarantees that we're putting in place, different structures that would not, in the cases of the underlying borrowers, we're aggregating different parties and putting together structures that wouldn't follow specific issues of the prudent investor rule.
Follow up, Representative Tuck.
Thank you. That makes sense on the prudent investor rule, but under traditional institutional financing criteria, what would be the limitations if you were to follow that?
It was broke up there. Could you repeat the question, please?
Yes, so that makes sense underneath the prudent investor rule. However, underneath the traditional institutional financing criteria, what would be the limitations to prevent you from following that?
Ultimately, what we're looking at is the specific loan programs that are being established and creating the environment that's for that in the way that we're applying the capital. The way that ADA has applied that within the loan participation program is one of the examples, our development project finance. It has not specifically been required to follow that. It gives us the flexibility to really design the programs for what is Alaska's requirements. And that's what we're asking for in that flexibility with the legislation.
If I may follow up.
Follow up, Representative Tuck.
Let me just clarify. What are the restrictions that you're trying to avoid so you have that flexibility?
In this case, it's ultimately the underlying programs, the loans itself. We don't know what the requirements are going to be. If we're looking at the different forms of sustainable energy project development, we really want to be able to cater it to what's needed within the communities. So ultimately, if we have specific credit requirements or specific performance requirements that are attached with it, we would rather have flexibility to address the programs with the credit enhancement that needs to be structured, the bundling of the different programs, have the flexibility as well to access the external capital markets in that structure that in some cases that would ultimately be necessary to comply, but they may not be the ultimate form of the private sector partner that we're working with.
So if I may,
Representative Tuck.
That's great that you want to do all of those things. You're just explaining everything you want to do. I just want to know what are the restrictions. So if you don't have the answer to that for right now, that's all right. But I would like to know what parts of the our traditional institutional financing criteria that is the hindrance to you doing everything that you just said you wanted to do. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I actually have a question myself. So I'd like to go to the definitions of sustainable energy development that's found within this bill. And so I'm curious about line B, building energy efficiency, including fuel switching to renewable fuels and electrification. I'm just wondering if this could be seen as a limitation on what could be covered under building energy efficiency and whether or not that should be bifurcated. And hopefully that's a simple, short answer, but hoping that you could address that.
Through the chair, Chairman Shragi, what I'm actually now going to the definition that you were looking for. Could you again please repeat the question?
Yeah, so under the definitions here, so item B, building energy efficiency, including fuel switching to renewable fuels and electrification. Is there any chance that that could limit the scope of what would be included under building energy efficiency to where this no longer meets the intent of the program?
Chairman, I don't believe so. I don't believe that the language in this case would say that it would limit the amount of what we can do under energy efficiency. I believe what it's just trying to identify is that it would also include fuel switching to renewable fuels and electrification, not limited to just that.
Okay, and then I have just a couple other technical questions here under the definition. So under item G for golf, electrical vehicle charging and fueling infrastructure. I'm just curious, the word fueling, do electrical vehicles typically need fueling, or why is that included in the definition there? I'm curious.
Chairman, the electrical vehicles do not need fueling, they need charging. And fueling in this case would be energy efficient, other forms of fueling that would be included in this and not limited to just electrical charging.
And it looks like Mr. Shub would like to weigh in, if you could, please.
Yes, thank you. Just one other definition of fueling of why that is often included in some of these definitions is for the potential of future hydrogen-fueled vehicles, which is a new technology that is not commercially available now but is envisioned in some of this similar legislation.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Mr. Shub, you may be the appropriate person to answer my next question, which is under H, hotel. Just any other emissions reduction or energy efficiency technology the authority determines to be consistent with the program? Could you give me some examples of what would be included under item H that isn't included in the definitions above? I just want to make sure that we have appropriate guardrails up on this program.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the legislation now. I think in other conversations where folks point to this, I think the most common thing that is identified is carbon capture technology or direct air capture, sort of air emissions-based reduction solutions that are specifically designed to limit emissions that are continuing as opposed to sort of replace existing emissions technology.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Tuck has a question.
Thank you. And following that same line of thought on H, what about nuclear technology? Would that apply as well since that is a emissions reduction technology?
So this is Jeff's response. It definitely could qualify under that. I certainly know as envisioned based on legislation written in other geographies that it's never really been a material option for a ton of reasons. The most relevant of which is those projects are many billions of dollars and would far outstrip the financing capacity, although technically I think it could be deemed qualifying.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I got a new line of questioning when you're ready.
I'm ready for that, Representative Tuck.
Thank you. And this is going back to the ADA board versus the AEA board. Is it written in statute that they shall be the same, or is it just a makeup in the same and we so happen to have board appointments that went to both that are identical? I'm just trying to figure out why we have two boards housed in the same building. I mean, really, the both entities are housed, I believe, housed in the same building. Why would we have I know it's written in statute. But was it intentional to have the two boards operate independently with different members that have the same makeup and we just happen to appoint the same people to both? Or is there somewhere in statute that requires them to be the same board members on each board?
Through the chair, I would Representative Tuck, I'd prefer to provide you something in writing that details the reasons behind that, that addresses your questions.
Thank you very much.
Because there is some history that's attached with that.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thank
Wonderful.
You.
And you wouldn't, if you wouldn't mind providing that to the chair, we'll get that to all the committee members. Thank you.
Sure.
Are there any other questions from committee members? Not seeing any further questions, I'd like to let the committee members know that the amendments deadline for HB 170 will be this coming Monday, April 19th at 1 p.m. Our next hearing will be Tuesday, April 20th, where the committee will consider amendments and hear public testimony on HB 170. I again want to extend a sincere thank you to all of our presenters today. Your testimony was greatly appreciated. And with nothing else before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 12:14 p.m.